I next met with Dr. Paul Richardson, and to begin, I asked him to discuss his vision of the biology of myeloma from the perspective of the treatment strategy of maximal tumor suppression initially, followed by long-term or indefinite treatment.
The question really is incredibly complex because myeloma is such a heterogeneous disease, and most importantly, it changes within a patient over time. And I think that's something that is, for folks in practice, very challenging, because at the end of the day, this is not a leukemia or a lymphoma, which is relatively linear. This has the complexity and heterogeneity of breast cancer in the way that it interplays with its neighborhood and microenvironment. But at the same time, it's much more dangerous in a sense because, of course, it's a hematologic cancer with systemic manifestations. So it has this incredible sort of, as I think of how I treat myeloma, I think of it as a chess game. And you have to make tactical and strategic decisions in patient care. So strategic decisions are based upon long-term views that now median survivals are 10. If we're lucky and doing well in a particular patient, we see 15 to 20-year survivals. Having said that, we still see in high-risk patients far shorter survivals, where 5 to 7-year survivals in aggressive myeloma can be achieved. Unfortunately, they can be even shorter than that if disease is particularly resistant to treatment. And I think what is really important to sort of grasp conceptually in myeloma is this whole issue of clonal heterogeneity and diversity and genomic instability. And we have to realize now that in the old days, when your median survival was 3 to 5 years, long-term consequences to a patient that are 10, 15 years out weren't relevant or weren't as relevant. There most certainly are now. And I think what we're realizing is that some of our old war horses were great tools at the time. But in reality, as we move into the 21st century, we have to be very much more tailored in our approach. And conceptually, I'd say this then matters in where we are with transplant. Transplant is an incredibly important modality in younger patients for sure. But having said that, how we deliver it with high-dose melphalan as our conditioning regimen, the fact that that's a highly genotoxic drug, however good it's been in the past, is very relevant to the future. So that being the case, we have to think very carefully how we use transplant, in my opinion, going forward, because we have excellent new tools. And those excellent new tools, I think, obviously include the antibodies, include the platforms of the triplet therapies that we have, include obviously other small molecules, and most importantly, the truly revolutionary new approaches in immune therapy, ranging from CAR T therapy, which obviously has shown great promise, to antibody drug conjugates, which I think are particularly fascinating, and the so-called bispecific T-cell engagers, or BiTEs, which are early but promising. And then, of course, there are a variety of other strategies that are in development in the immune space. I mean, these don't just include the antibodies and cellular therapies per se, but also the new what we call cell mods, or really these are extremely potent IMiDs, which are showing promise in early phase trials. So there's an array of new approaches that are coming that are changing the way we treat patients in the longer term. And at the same time, we also have novel chemotherapeutics that have the opportunity to be more targeted potentially and cause less injury to normal tissue. And that too may have promise as well. So an array of different opportunities for our patients that may allow us to be more tailored. And for example, at ASH last year, there were two abstracts that really caught my eye. There was RVD-DARA plus transplant, which we are part of. That was a study my colleague, Dr. Peter Voorhees, led, and I'm the senior investigator of it. And we were very pleased with RVD-DARA plus transplant. The results were outstanding. What was fascinating to me, though, was that RVD-isatuximab, in an early phase study presented by Dr. Osio from Spain, achieved a similar rate of MRD negativity as did the Griffin study with transplant, but in Enrique's study, there was no transplant used. So that was fascinating. It's a cross-trial comparison, so we have to be careful, but it's an interesting and provocative observation. And then the most important study, I think, of ASH last year in the transplant space was the Forte trial, a beautiful study led by Dr. Francesca Gay. And Francesca presented beautiful information in which she showed that KRD times 12 achieved the same thing as KRD times 8 plus transplant in terms of overall response, quality of response, and MRD negativity. Now, she updated that at ASCO with what I thought was a fascinating analysis, that if you looked at standard risk patients, the outcomes were the same, whether you had a transplant early or kept it in reserve. The high-risk patients, fascinatingly, the rate of relapse appeared higher in those who did not have the stem cell transplant at early look. The challenge with that analysis, which has to be borne in mind, is that the study incorporated a second randomization of lenalidomide versus lenalidomide carfilzomib. And obviously we don't know to which arm the patients were assigned in the context of their maintenance to date. So consequently, that high-risk group of early relapses may in fact reflect an inadequate maintenance, i.e. lenalidomide carfilzomib may not have been used in those patients who relapsed in the non-transplanted arm. And conversely, of course, it may be true that irrespective of their randomization in maintenance, the transplant made a difference. We just don't know that yet. But what I think the message was is in standard risk patients, KRD without transplant used early seemed to be performing just as well as KRD plus transplant. High risk, we need to be careful and we need to think again.